welcome to House of Comments. I'm Charlotte Henry. In the glorious sun. I'm here. The legs are out. Oh,
finally.
The shorts are on. Hello, Emma Bunnell. How are you?
I am well. I'm very well.
I'm so pleased to hear it. We're going for this show to one of your favourite parts of the country.
We are the glorious, glorious Garden of England.
The Garden of England, Kent, because that's where all the action has been this week. I guess we should go in chronological order, because earlier this week, Natalie Elphick, I can't believe I'm saying this sentence, but here we go. I'm going to do it. Deep breaths. Natalie Elphick, the Dover MP, defected from the Conservatives to Labour.
Yeah. Yeah. Not a sentence you ever expected to say, right?
No, that is fair to say. And not a sentence many Labour MPs expected to have to process either. The reason this is so strange, right? Look, we've had a couple of defections. There was Dr. Dan Poulter a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And that kind of made sense. He was upset about the NHS, the state of the NHS. Not a particularly right-wing Conservative MP. Okay. Natalie Elphick is a particularly right-wing Conservative MP.
She is. I mean, she has nuanced positions on some things, but she was ERG.
Yeah, she was in the European Research Group.
She, she has banged the drum very hard on Brexit, which doesn't sit that comfortably with the vast majority of the Labour Party, though there are Lexiteers.
Yes, there are.
But they would have a different interpretation of what Brexit is for than she would, I would suspect. She, she's sat on the right of the Tory party.
Absolutely.
And that makes this a much more controversial crossing of the floor than I was going to say streams. There, I'm such an addict. Than Dan Poulter's was.
Yeah, and we've had a couple of others. I'll come on to her husband and all that mess in a moment. What I've been wondering this week, and I deliberately didn't text you and ask this because I wanted to hear it sort of fresh on air.
Yeah, yeah.
What is, first of all, your personal reaction? I'd be fascinated to know. And second, all the people in the Labour Party, sort of the activist base that are your very close friends, what's been the feedback and the perception? Because I'm damn sure you've been talking to a lot of people about it this week.
So I'd say it's kind of mixed, and so was mine. I am queasy about her past.
Right.
Very queasy about her past, if I'm honest. The stuff about her husband, which, as you say, we'll come on to.
Yes.
Some of the things that she's tweeted about, say, Marcus Rashford.
Yes, she had a row with Marcus Rashford, didn't she? She was the sort of got back to playing football, stop doing
politics.
Get
back to playing football, stop caring about children eating, which, I don't agree with at all. And her positions on many, many things with which I fundamentally disagree. I absolutely understand why the leadership did this. Stephen Bush has a very, very good line that he wheels out quite often, which is where most people get their politics from, or their understanding of what's happening in politics, is from the short news breaks on commercial radio. Very few people think about politics to even 1 or 2% of the degree that people like you and I and the Labour activists that I've been texting with do. And when you listen to how this was reported on those short commercial breaks on commercial radio, it was exactly the message that Keir Starmer would have wanted.
Yeah, so what you're saying is basically most people, all they have heard this week is Conservative MP for Dover has joined Labour because she says Rishi Sunak is incompetent and can't stop the boats.
Yeah, exactly, which is the ideal message for the Labour Party.
But there has been a backlash from MPs. They were kind of come on to Sir Keir Starmer's speech this morning, but one of the journalists there pointed out Jess Phillips was very unhappy. She's not the only one.
Yeah, there has absolutely been a backlash from MPs and from members and from activists. I wrote a piece myself that said, here's where
you,
I think...
You did, we'll link to it.
There are issues around this. As I said, it was tactically smart, but it may be strategically more problematic. But what I'm saying is, I have you in order to not just go, oh, what are they thinking? You have to think, what are they thinking? And that's what they were thinking.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of the sounds I've heard coming out of the Leader of the Opposition's office seems a little bit of arrogance. Oh, you know, if people are worried about it, they can go away. We're going to win the election.
I mean, some of the briefing from Lotto should, I mean, people should be sacked for a lot of the briefing that comes out of Lotto. And I'm, you know,
because if
ridiculously over macho.
Yeah. I mean, if your whole line is we're not being complacent, and some of the things we've heard coming out of Sir Keir Starmer's office, that doesn't quite match, I have to say.
Yeah, exactly. And it's more the, it's not the complacency thing so much as just, you do have to work with your party sometimes.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, change Labour and all of that, but there is, I think Neil Kinnock put it beautifully when he said, even a broad church has walls.
Right. So do you think Natalie Alpic is welcome to that, you know, to sit on the same pews as you?
Everybody is entitled to change their mind. I think she needs to demonstrate over the next period of time that she has indeed changed her mind. She started with an apology over the stuff around her husband, which is a good start. You know, politics, the art of politics is persuasion. So if we don't believe we can change minds, then what are we doing in this business? So there's that. I am, on the other hand, very, very glad that we're not standing down the Labour candidate in that constituency.
Right. Well, Natalie Alpic is not standing
and, it, and expecting Labour activists to canvass for her.
Well, I think there's a bit of luck there because Natalie Alpic has already decided she's not going to re-stand for election.
She hadn't decided before this decision.
Right.
It was announced alongside the decision that she wouldn't re-stand.
Oh, I missed up the timeline there. So she will not be standing for re-election. She, as you say, the existing Labour candidate is going to continue to be the PPC there, which I think is interesting and has probably helped because in reality, we're only talking a few months. Yeah.
Up to at most January of next year.
Well, so we've mentioned her husband a few times. Her husband was Charlie Alpic, previously the Conservative MP for Dover. He was found guilty of sexually assaulting two women in 2020. Mrs. Alpic said she was an easy target. Her husband was a, quote, an easy target for false allegations. That's because he was, quote, attractive. We'll cast our own judgments on that. I don't like it.
No. Was he?
No. We're not discussing. No, we're not going down that path.
Really, really not. He looks like a potato.
Right, thank you, Emma. She acknowledged that this would all come up when she defected. I'll read you her statement in full because I think that's only fair. She said, "The period of 2017 to 2020 was an incredibly stressful and difficult one for me as I learned more about the person I thought I knew. I knew it was far harder for the women who had to relive their experiences and give evidence against him. I had previously and do condemn his behaviour towards other women and towards me. It was right that he was prosecuted and I'm sorry for the comments that I made about his victims." She also told BBC political editor Kristen Mason that she wanted to apologise directly to those women. So there we go. She dealt with that. It will be interesting to see how this plays out. My guess is that it will be a little bit of a ruckus.
Yeah, it's probably a storm in a teacup unless she says something dumb between now and the election.
And I suspect she won't say very much between now and the election.
If she's got any sense, she'll just keep her head down. The question is whether she's got any sense. I think that is where
and
the
whether the
lies.
Wits and the leader of the opposition office can control that for however long it's necessary.
So where I think the bigger problem lies is the kind of comments that she has made in the past would be enough for a long-standing Labour member or MP to have the whip suspended or have their membership suspended.
What are the specific comments you're talking about?
Well, the stuff around disbelieving rape victims would be a disciplinary matter.
Mm-hmm. I'm not commenting because you can, I think, well imagine my view on that.
Yeah. And I think the problem, and frankly, Labour's disciplinary processes are, I think opaque would be an incredibly kind word. I think I described them in my piece as shabby and secretive.
And it's not the first time you've made such comments.
No, I'll be writing a lot more about this in the coming weeks. I'm doing a piece on the Greens this weekend, so I'm going to switch my phone off because they've gone mental online as much as they've gone mental in real life. There are very, very widespread accusations that the disciplinary process is being used as a factional weapon. I think it's slightly more nuanced than that. But on the other hand, that charge isn't completely without foundation.
Mm.
And frankly, it should be easily dismissible. And because it is not easily dismissible, it makes our disciplinary process even more of a joke than its shabbiness and its secretiveness.
Would you go and campaign for Natalie Alfert?
No. But then there are lots of Labour MPs I wouldn't campaign for either, to be fair. I'm going to spend my time in Chingford and Woodford Green, which is my nearest marginal.
If Natalie Alfert is a member of the Labour Party, should Diane Abbott be?
Yes. But I've said this before. I said that I think Diane Abbott should have the whip restored. We've talked about this in the past.
And Momentum have made the same point this week.
And that is the thing. You know, Diane did something very stupid and then she apologised and has been in this stupid limbo for so long that the process is the punishment. You know, that phrase, the process is the punishment, is the epitome of the Labour disciplinary process. And lots of people are put through it for spurious reasons because people make vexatious complaints and there is very little thresholding of those complaints. So, for example, there was a councillor in Hackney, there was a vexatious complaint made against, sorry, council candidate in Hackney, a vexatious complaint was made against her. She was suspended a week before the election. She then was reinstated the night before the election. Now, with her, it happened very, very quickly. But with many, many others, they are stuck in limbo with no, sometimes not even told what they're accused of. Mm. Sometimes not,
you know,
and almost never told how long the process is, where they are in the process, what's happening in the process.
You know what? I reckon someone should write a play about the internal workings of the Labour Party. I think it'd be fascinating.
Well, I mean, Kafka wrote a play about the Labour Party complaints process. I just wrote one about trigger balance.
One other interesting comment I just want to draw on kind of the Labour Party parliamentary party reaction. A friend of yours, Rosie Duffield, said, described herself as baffled. Well, she said her colleagues were baffled, quote, by the defection. And she said she did not believe for a second that Mrs. Alfert had suddenly transformed into a Labour MP. I am finding this hard to get my head around, I have to say.
As I say, I think it was tactically astute for the reasons that I've set out in terms of the first day story. But strategically, it raises more questions than it answers. Because
do you think they're getting a bit arrogant, the Labour leadership?
I think Lotto is incredibly arrogant. I think the boys around Keir Starmer, whether Keir Starmer himself is arrogant, I don't know. But I think he employs people to be arrogant on his behalf and ultimately he's responsible for that.
It just strikes me that I know the results did, Labour did very well in the results. I think, and I picked this up listening to another podcast, I think people in Labour and the general political commentariat and whatever else have forgotten still quite what a task it is to get a majority. I am totally convinced that Sir Keir Starmer is going to be the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. I think he's probably going to do it with a small majority.
I don't think that's true of where the Labour Party's at. I don't think you understand the Labour Party psyche. The Labour Party psyche, whether you were born after it or not, is permanently scarred by 1992.
Right.
Nobody in the Labour Party, up to and including myself, who has said, I think we probably will win, really believes in their heart that we will. Because we lived through 1992, or we know people who lived through 1992.
Okay.
And there is an arrogance in Lotto, but that arrogance is internal, not about whether we're going to win the election or not. There's a difference.
Okay.
They are absolutely cocksure about their swagger over the Labour Party. They are absolutely insecure about their swagger over the country.
That's a very interesting kind of dynamic to watch play out. Thank you. We should, I guess, bring this back to where it leaves Rishi Sunak. He's had a very good day today. The economic figures coming out are very, very good. There's growth in the economy. You know, Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor.
Less than 1% growth in the economy. Let's not gild the lily.
Well, if it had been a drop of the same amount, you'd
if
be
it had been a drop of the same amount, we would have stayed in recession.
So I think you've got to. I think it's worthy of a win.
I mean, yeah, it's a win. It's just not a stonking win. I mean, I just think.
I think that's very disingenuous.
No, I don't think it is. We are not a country where growth. Look at how the American economy is growing. It's growing like billio. We've got 0.6%, and we think woohoo.
I think it's more that it's indicative of things we hope turning a corner. So I do think that's a bit disingenuous. I understand the point you're making. It's beaten predictions as well. Anyway, my point is I didn't want to get into the economics particularly, although we should acknowledge the positive news. My point really was this losing another MP is a blow. We've already had Nadeem Zahawi this week announce he's adding to the list of Conservative MPs that are standing down. I rather liked his letter. I suspect you thought it was pompous nonsense.
Pompous? Nadeem Zahawi?
Okay, very good. So that's where we kind of are for Rishi Sunak. I guess it's just it just feels like another blow. Every time he has something sort of positive, something negative also happens to him.
Yeah, he is incredibly unlucky in that way. And I think
at a certain point, is he unlucky or is he making his own bad luck?
It's a bit of both. He came in at the fag end of a wasted government. And all of the things that were done at the beginning of that government that were wrong, and there were so many, it's hard to count, but...
You're talking about Liz Truss's...
No, I'm talking about David Cameron.
Oh, okay.
David Cameron and George Osborne cutting the state to the bone. And then the problem Labour had, and where Labour went really, really wrong between 2010 and 2015... was talking about austerity as if it was an immediate problem. And lots of people didn't feel that immediacy, partly because we were still coming out of the 2008 crash, so things weren't great to start with. What austerity was a long-term problem.
Yeah, I want to just focus on this week in terms of where it leaves Sunak.
What I'm saying is that Sunak came in as a lot of the problems that had been planted for him by David Cameron in terms of austerity and Brexit, Theresa May in terms of not being able to manage Brexit and cutting police numbers when she was in the Home Office, Boris Johnson in terms of now people absolutely don't trust the Tory party at all over anything, and Liz Truss crashed the economy. Liz Truss was Liz Truss. I mean, you know, that's all you need to say. So in terms of luck, but also choice, that's where he's at. That's the party that he's inherited. And a party like that, with that many stored up problems, is going to have negative story after negative story after negative story. Some of them are down to decisions that Sunak himself has made. He's not a very good politician. He doesn't really understand politics and or people. But some of it is down to the fact that he's of his inheritance. And I think it's worth people... who are neutral saying that. It's also worth Labour punching that bruise, because what Labour doesn't need
is Sunak going. That's a lovely
turn of phrase, thank
you.
And it being, oh, the Tories have changed then. because this is a cumulative effect of all Tories.
There's a couple of things I've been pondering this week. This is how rock and roll I am whilst I'm going for a walk or whatever. A couple of things. First of all, I think there's been a bit, you know, when Sunak has talked about AIs, I should say there's a Chris Stoker Walker pointed this out on my other podcast, The Edition, that there's a huge AI summit happening in Seoul and sort of no one's really going, including Britain. But there have been moments, and there was some recently, where Sunak gets to talk about tech and growth and investment in the UK, where he's really good. He could have done, and I saw someone tweet about this, forgive me, I can't remember who it was, he could have done that techno-optimist thing. Forget the sit-down interview with Elon Musk, which was a bit weird. This is what he genuinely believes in, right? He is a person who's engaged in technology, who's engaged in business. He could have made that his thing, a modern Britain, and he just hasn't. And I think that's a real missed opportunity. I think it's a real shame, because he could have done that. My other point after all of this, and it's really been a thing that's come to me this week, I don't want a Labour government, but I think it's time for a general election, because this is just painful now.
Yeah, it's painful to watch. It's painful for the country. It's painful for the country's reputation. We just look like we've got a zombie government that's going to stagger on for 6 months. And that's not good for anyone.
That's really the point I've got to. And I hadn't got to it for a while, because as I say, I don't really want a Labour government.
Well, you're getting one.
But I am going to get one. But I just think, when you're at the point where nothing you do can work.
Here's a question for you, Charlotte. Do you want a Tory government?
Well, this is the other bite. I don't want this to, you know, the way they're behaving at the moment. No, not really.
That is the binary choice in this country. You're a Lib Dem voter, but you know you're not going to get a Lib Dem government, whatever Joe Swinson told you last time around.
Well, indeed. And this is, of course, is the dilemma I've always had. And I just think, you know, you know what I thought about Boris Johnson and how that all went and Partygate and all of that. You've seen my full-blown rage at that.
Well, indeed. But I remember a night in 2019, December 2019, when you were cheering the pants off him.
Well, you're absolutely right. And that was more a Jeremy Corbyn thing than a Boris Johnson thing.
But again, it was a binary choice between the two.
Absolutely.
Neither was an acceptable option. But
absolutely,
I think
right.
It was underplayed how unacceptable an option Boris Johnson was.
Probably, but it was also, I was thoroughly depressed that the choice was Boris Johnson or Jeremy Corbyn. Thoroughly. It was appalling. But you're absolutely right. I make no bones or no apology for being utterly delighted Jeremy Corbyn never became the Prime Minister of this country.
But you were not just celebrating Jeremy Corbyn losing, you were celebrating Boris Johnson winning. And that's the problem that we had at that election.
Oh, it was a massive problem. I couldn't agree with you more. But I will, I will never make an apology for being pleased that Jeremy Corbyn never became the Prime Minister of this country. But where do we go now? I don't know. And this is why it's taken me so long to get to the point of being like, oh, sod it, let's have an election. Do you know what you know when you're like spring cleaning your home or something and you're just like,
no.
I've just got to get.
That's not true. I did spring clean this year.
Very clean and tidy person.
I am now. God, if you told my mother that, she'd be like absolutely horrified.
Well, we
because
get
I
your
was
mother
so
on the
untidy until I was about 25, and then I suddenly became tidy.
You just
I'm
need
not clean.
Sometimes
I don't
you just
clean,
need
I am
to
a cleaner.
Throw stuff away. Been a load of stuff and sort of renew. And it feels like that's where we are as a country.
Yeah, we need a fresh start.
And
we
in the
renewal.
Same way, I wasn't really happy with either Corbyn or Boris Johnson becoming the Prime Minister. It was genuinely a lesser of two evils for me. I mean that sincerely.
But I think it was the lesser of two evils for lots of people. We
Correct.
Just have different interpretations of what that evil was.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I think for most people, anti-Semitism is always evil, but yes.
Yeah, no, come on, Charlotte. That's not fair. That's not what I said.
No, it's not what you said, no.
I said there are two evils.
Yes.
You're making a choice between.
Yes.
And Boris Johnson also has a history of racism. Let's not forget that in this conversation. So we're not choosing between a racist and a non-racist either.
As I say, I just repeat my point. It was a lesser two evils. I make no apologies for
what
not
I'm
wanting.
Saying is lots of people when looking at those two evils, made different judgments, and I don't think it's fair to say one chose evil and one didn't.
Okay. But where we are now, which is really what I want to talk about, not reliving our freezing cold night on College Green where we were. I think we needed a big cuddle at one point. We were so cold. But
ironically, I left you to go to the cast Christmas party of a immersive play about rescuing the 1979 Labour government.
There's a moment where we need renewal, and it feels like that, whoever I don't want to come into power or not.
Yeah.
That's the point I've got to this week.
I mean, you know, you're going to throw your vote away on a Lib Dem. I'm going to vote for my safe Labour MP. We'll probably go and do our activism somewhere where it might make a difference.
I don't think I'll do some activism, actually, because I'll stick to the journalism, but...
Well, I will, because while I am still a journalist, I'm basically a commentator journalist who's happy to be activist, and I do think there's a difference.
There is. You don't claim neutrality.
Yeah, no, and I'm really, really open about that. And yeah. I think it's really important to always put my cards on the table when I'm talking about... So I'm frequently on GB News, as you know.
I do.
And when I'm saying good things about Keir Starmer, I will be honest about where I'm coming from. When I'm saying bad things about Rishi Sunak, I will say, as someone who is a Labour supporter, I wish he was doing this differently. But equally, I will also try to say, I think Rishi has done this bit well. I think Keir's done this bit badly.
Well, talking of things people do well, we're going to return to your favourite part of the country.
Well, I have to say, to be fair, Dover is not a bit of Kent I know that well. My family are from round the coast in Thanet. My university is in Canterbury.
Right, yeah.
In fact, one of the only times I've ever been to Dover was when a university mate of mine was done for poll tax evasion.
I think this is not a story for a show.
With him for a day out, which was bizarre.
Right. So Keir Starmer was down on the coast, not for poll tax evasion, but to talk about Rwanda. Well, to talk about migration, obviously...
Yeah, he wasn't there to talk about Rwanda. He was there to talk about the alternative that Labour are proposing.
He's gone a bit Thunderbirds and he's having a new task force. I have to tell you, I thought this was one of Starmer's best ever speeches.
I thought he was very good, yeah.
I thought he did really well this morning. He was serious, he was grown up, he was compassionate to the most vulnerable people who were dealing with this issue.
He was very clear that this isn't about punishing these vulnerable people, but about saving them from the vultures.
Right. And this is what I want to say. He was really focused on what I consider to be the real issue, which is the people smugglers.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
So I was really impressed. I did have a giggle because he mentioned his time at the CBS quite a lot. He managed to get football in after about 3 minutes, but... Teasing aside, I thought he did really well. Obviously, he...
Well, the football part I can take or leave, but I think actually he's right to mention his time at the CPS, and he's been doing that more, I think, since Tom Baldwin's book came out. And the narrative within that book made it clear how Keir can use that history to demonstrate his future.
Right. He used lots of phrases like replacing gimmick with graft, called Rwanda a gimmick, not a solution. I agree with that. Not only do I think the Rwanda thing is just immoral, money-wasting nonsense, it is a gimmick. And the thing that's different, and this is sort of why I talked about Rishi Sunak as well, is finally, it seems like Starmer now is having a vision that is tying everything together. Right?
Yeah.
Suddenly there is a broader picture. I think it's now harder and harder to say Labour doesn't have a plan. And
although the Daily Mail journalist immediately, like, it was so funny. Keir Starmer's like, here's my plan. And the Daily Mail journalist immediately turned around and said, do you have a plan? I was like, were you listening? Like, are you in the right press conference?
I have to say, I don't like to particularly have a go at colleagues, fellow journalists, but as a media writer, I often have to. And I'm sorry, I thought some of the questions in these things are a bit
so
nonsense.
Pathetic, aren't they?
Well, they keep asking the same question.
So it's so that they can be the one they play on their clip, but it's just pointless. But that one wasn't even the same question. It was like, literally, here is a quite comprehensive plan to set out a task force to use the money from the Rwanda scheme to do it. Introduce new counterterrorism laws. Use the experience he had in counterterrorism to break the people smuggling gangs. Quite detailed set of proposals.
Oh,
and to immediately turn around and say, "Do you have a plan?" was just, it's not just bad journalism, it's client journalism.
You don't have to lay out everything before your manifesto, but this, for a non-manifesto announcement, was as comprehensive as it needs to be. Yeah. And I'm being very generous to Labour and Sakir because I actually think he did really well this morning, and I'm happy to say so. This was serious. His presentation has got so much better. Interesting today, what was the thing I noticed? Suit and tie. Didn't have the open shirt this time.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I mean, it's not that interesting. To be fair, he had a suit, not a tie, at conference
tie was
until
back.
Some dickhead poured glitter.
Yeah,
on it.
No, but the tie was on this morning. The tie, yeah. You know, serious grown up. I honestly thought he did really
okay,
well.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to my trip to Dover because the absolute funniest line that came out of that was when my darling friend, who I won't name, who I haven't seen for 20 odd years since, because we haven't kept in touch since university, but he came out with this phrase that sort of spoke both to working class values, but also to poverty of ambition sometimes. He said, "I don't know about you, but I was always brought up to wear a suit to court."
And Sir Keir Starmer clearly did the same. He got
yeah,
his suit
exactly.
out.
Got his suit out.
Got his suit out.
They expect a politician to wear a suit and tie.
Dusted off his suit. The other thing that strikes me is if I was a Conservative MP watching this, I'd be thinking, why on earth couldn't we do this? There is nothing really, as far as I can tell, that a moderate Conservative leader and government couldn't have said.
Absolutely. This is the thing. What are they going to disagree with? Other than scrapping the gimmick, because they're very wedded to the gimmick, what are they going to disagree with in this speech? And that is where I think it's quite clever. He used a phrase, I wrote it down because I thought it was important, the fair-minded majority.
Yeah.
And I think that is absolutely where Starmer's pitch is. And I think as the Tories chase what they think to a certain extent are absolutely right, the reform vote is, they are moving further and further away from the fair-minded majority.
Yeah.
And if Labour are putting their tanks on that lawn, that's a really good space for them.
I think so. I can imagine. Do you think some on the left of Labour would be a bit uncomfortable with some of what he
said?
Yeah,
there
today?
Are. So, I mean, and I think he actually referenced in his speech, there are people on the hard right who just want to take in no refugees at all.
Sure.
There are people on the hard left who want to have no borders at all. Labour is in neither of those positions. It is where the fair-minded majority are.
It's very interesting. I thought, as I say, I thought he did well. I think it's going to be very hard for a Conservative MP or Rishi Sunak to stand up and have too much to disagree with on this.
If they try, they'll make themselves look bad. That's
probably
the problem.
Probably that's true. And I just, I think they've sort of navigated this pretty well. Of course, look, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating. Does this work? You can't
judge
that
absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. And it won't work overnight. And we are an impatient people. Social media has made us much more impatient, I think. The pace of news will expect results quicker than they can be delivered. But ultimately, the election will be in 5 years' time and the judgment will be when whether it's delivered by then.
Yeah, and I guess they could hold the line on this. I have to say, I think they'll be pretty pissed off in CCHQ that as there's good economic news, you know, out of recession, very strong growth predictions. My guess is that a lot of the conversation will be dominated by Starmer's speech. I mean,
well, yeah,
both.
And it's partly that electoral dynamic of most people in the media assume with reasonable evidence, very good evidence from last week, that Starmer is going to be prime minister this time next year. So why do you care what Rishi Sunak has to say about an awful lot?
Well, because he's still the prime minister, but yes.
Well, I mean, he hasn't got an awful lot of time to do an awful lot more legislating. So
he hasn't. No, that's correct.
So in terms of where what's going to happen, Starmer probably has a bigger voice than Sunak does.
And there was obviously Yvette Cooper there. There was Natalie Elphick and the candidate who's will try to replace her as the MP for that area there.
Mike Tapps, I think his name is.
So there was all of that. I think it could have been, I think the truth is they both had a decent week, Starmer and Sunak. I suspect they'll be frustrated in the number 10 in CCHQ.
Yeah, but I mean, they don't get a free run at the media. That's not how it works.
But they don't get a free run at the media because that's not the name of the game at all. You've got to be clever about it.
Yeah. You know, Labour clearly knew this economic news was coming out today.
Of course, yeah, being the great, yeah.
Rachel Reeves preempted it with her speech on gaslighting.
Yes.
I think that, you know, that we are, you know, Labour clearly knew this news was coming out today. How do we get the headlines? Well, let's go to Dover and make a speech on immigration.
I assume, because these things don't happen overnight, the conversations with Natalie Elphick.
Those have been ongoing for a while, but they didn't need to have her to do this. It was icing rather than cake.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really helped.
Yeah, it helped, but they didn't, you know, as I say, it's icing rather than cake. They could have made a speech on immigration today, whatever happened.
Sure, but I think it brought the whole week together rather nicely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there we go. Emma, really lovely to have you on the show.
Lovely to be here.
Where can people keep up with you?
You can read my newsletter, as I have written most recently about Natalie Elphick, and I am writing about the Greens this weekend, and I will be turning my notifications off on Twitter. But I am on Twitter at EmmaBurnell_, and my newsletter is Hard Thinking on the Soft Left on Substack.
I'm at theaddition.net. You can subscribe there or newsletter.theaddition.net if you just want to get the newsletter quickly and straight away. We would love you also to head over and subscribe to our paid version, which of course means you get both of our newsletters and the special parts of this podcast all for 50 quid. It's a bit bargain.
Which, given that each of our newsletters costs 50 quid on their own, is an incredible bargain.
Absolutely. So I hope you do that, and we'll see you next week.